We talk today with the great mathematician and computer scientist Gregory Chaitin on Mind Matters News.
Welcome to Mind Matters News, where artificial and natural intelligence meet head on. Here's your host, Robert J. Marks.
There are few people who can be credited without any controversy with the founding of a game-changing field of mathematics. We are really fortunate today to talk to Gregory Chaitin, who has that distinction. Professor Chaitin is a co-founder of the field of algorithmic information theory that explores the properties of computer programs. Professor Chaitin is the recipient of a handful of honorary doctorates for his landmark work, and as a recipient of the prestigious Leibniz Medal. Professor Chaitin, welcome.
Great to be with you today.
Thank you. Algorithmic information theory. When people first hear the term, at least at the lay level, their reaction is the field might be pretty dry and boring. But I tell them that algorithmic information theory, if you understand it, is more mind-blowing than any science fiction I've ever read or watched. So I hope in our chats that we have, we can convey some of the mind-blowing results springing out of algorithmic information theory. So before diving in, I hope you don't mind if I get a little personal. Your life has changed recently. You have two new children in your life.
Oh, yeah.
Joao, and how did I do in the pronunciation? That's a rough name to pronounce.
Yeah, it's actually in Spanish, it's Juan. John in English. Juan in Spanish, and the Portuguese pronunciation is a little different. It's more nasal. It's Juan.
Juan.
Juan. Juan. Okay. It's Juan. Yeah, and Juan Bernardo, who's three, and our little girl is going to be 11 months. Her name is Maria Clara.
That's wonderful. Now, this has been a life change for you, hasn't it?
Oh, sure. For anybody who has children, it's a life change, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I think we were sharing an email that I babysit for my grandson, and when I'm finished, I feel successful if I've kept him alive. He gets into all sorts of problems. He likes to pull things down from the shelf on him. He climbs the stairs, and I'm afraid he'll fall down and need intensive care. And it's just one thing after another. So I expect you've experienced similar stuff, right?
You bet. Actually, now that I'm a father, it seems like a miracle that children survive.
Yes, it's amazing. Leonard Euler, if I remember, when he lost the sight of one of his eyes, came out with a positive statement. He said, "This is good because I have less to distract me from my mathematics." And I'm sure, but in a much more positive sense, this has kind of distracted you from your intellectual pursuits because it's not a distraction. It's a wonderful addition to life. But have you found that to be the truth?
Well, that's a good question. I've worked a lot on mathematics, and I've sort of done what I had intended to do. So I welcome this new project.
New project. I read Virginia's comment in your new book, which we're going to post a link to it on the podcast notes. But she said that your children have completed your marriage's incompleteness problem. I thought that was hilarious. That really cracked me up.
Yeah, that was very clever of her, wasn't it?
That was very clever. I think that our audience, much of our audience, might not get the humor in that, but I think as we go on, we can probably get this.
It's a joke for logicians.
Yes, it is. It is. So it was. It was funny. It cracked me up.
It's a wonderful experience having children. It's true that both of us are older than normal, my wife and I. In my case, substantially older than normal, my wife not that much. But we wanted very much to have children, and it's a gift from God. We managed somehow.
That's wonderful.
As a doctor said in the Middle Ages, I believe he said something like, "I attended the patient and God cured him." So
exactly.
in spite of all our efforts, it might not have worked, but we're very happy to have our two little children.
It is wonderful. I think it says in Psalm 139 that we are fearfully and wonderfully made, and boy, that certainly is the case, isn't it? Speaking of youth, you did a lot of amazing stuff in your youth. I think you were in the Bronx, New York, is that right?
Well, we were living in Manhattan, a very nice location, Madison Avenue, a block from Central Park.
Oh my goodness.
In the mid-60s. 68th Street, between 68th and 69th on Madison Avenue is a very nice neighborhood still.
But I think I read you went to the Bronx High School, though, right?
I did go to the Bronx High School of Science, which was a treat. And I was also at the same time, I passed an exam. In my first year at the Bronx High School of Science, I learned that there was something called the Science Honors Program at Columbia University, which was a weekend activities for very bright students interested in the sciences.
Mm-hmm.
And I got in. And one of the privileges I got as a result was they gave me the run of the stacks at Columbia University, which is unbelievable.
Wow.
Yeah. So, for example, I was able to hold volumes of the collected works of Euler in my hands.
Wow.
Yeah. And the normal students, I don't think, are allowed to go in the stacks. At that time, they weren't. So this was an incredible treat. And another thing that happened was I came up with the idea of program size complexity and defining randomness in an essay question in the exam to get into the Science Honors Program at Columbia University.
Interesting. I know in your work that you looked at things like relativity. This was in your teens, for Pete's sakes, and quantum mechanics. And yeah. So what led you down the path of computer science and to do the founding of algorithmic information theory?
Well, I was always very interested in computers. They were just starting. At the Columbia Science Honors Program, they had a course where the kids could get access to computers. So I started programming in an assembly language, I think also in Fortran. There was a course given by a nice professor, and they let the kids run programs on big mainframes, which is what we had then.
Yes.
So I was programming in high school, which at that time was pretty unusual, right?
Yes.
Now it's not, I'm sure. So, I was reading Scientific American. At first, my mother would read it to me. I was reading it very young. For example, I remember vividly I'm not sure what year it was. Could it be 1958 or 1956 article on Gödel's proof with a fantastic photograph of Gödel where he looks sort of angrily at the camera with a blackboard behind him?
Oh, yes. And he has that silver streak of hair, I believe.
It's possible. And then in 58, I think it was, a book called Gödel's Proof came out. This was Nagel and Newman. They had written the article in Scientific American.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that book when it got published. I was 11. You know, I had permission to take out books from the adult section in the New York City Public Library. I had piles of books at home. And I was reading physics, mathematics. It was a nice time to be a kid growing up in Manhattan.
I guess, especially if you're interested in that sort of stuff. You said you had your hands on some of the original works of Euler.
Yeah.
Do you consider him, I consider him maybe, if not the greatest, but certainly the most prolific mathematician
yeah.
in history.
They may still be publishing his collected works. When I was a kid, there were many, many volumes, and there were going to be more. He's my favorite mathematician. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, it's sort of silly to rank people. People talk of Gauss as the prince of mathematics or something. As far as I'm concerned, it's Euler. If Gauss is the prince, then Euler is the king, you know?
Euler is the king.
Yeah. His papers are beautiful to read. He gives his whole train of thought, and it looks obvious. It looks obvious only while you're reading Euler. Gauss gives very concise papers that are very hard to decipher. But while you're reading Euler, you think, oh, I could have done this. But of course, only Euler could have done this.
Yeah, I understand when he lost the sight in both of his eyes, he would sit around in St. Petersburg with students and dictate his ideas to them because he wasn't able to see.
Yeah, but his productivity didn't go down.
his productivity didn't go down. Yeah. Just an astonishing mind.
Yeah, it's astonishing because you ask, where did all this creativity come from? You know, the new mathematics, beautiful new mathematics, was just pouring out of his head onto the paper. And the publishers couldn't keep up. So his paper, he had a pile of papers that he had. And every now and then, somebody would take some of them off the top, I think, and he would keep adding more. So so they weren't published in order that they were done. And when I was reading the collected works of Euler, the Russians had this pile of manuscripts that hadn't all been included in his collected works yet. So they were still, and they were being cagey. They weren't, they were going slow.
So you suspect that the works of Euler are still being translated, you believe?
I don't know. This was, what, 60 years ago? So maybe they finally... No, they were being published in the original language, which Latin I didn't know, but I knew French. So I could read his papers in French pretty much like I could read English. But in a lot of it was Latin, and then I had to struggle with a dictionary. But, you know, one knows the topic. If it was a paper on number theory, I knew some number theory. And so that was it was an absolute treat. I also had the collected works of Niels Heinrich Abel in my hands, a child prodigy who did some beautiful work. But Euler works on every possible topic. And so where does all this new mathematics, where does this creativity come from? You know, it seems to be, have a supernatural source. You know, there seems to be as if, yeah.
Oh, that's great. In fact, that's a topic I want to talk to you about later, yeah. Whether or not maybe the creativity might be, for example, non-algorithmic, non-computable.
Yeah, maybe God was talking to him. You know, Cantor thought that. So, because it's really hard to explain where all those new ideas came from. It's Ramanujan is another example like that.
Oh, he was that Indian that knew incredibly intuitive things about number theory, which were just mind-blowing.
Yeah, he didn't have a formal education in math. And he said that there was a Hindu goddess, I can't recall her name, he said that she would tell him mathematics while he slept. So
really? Okay.
That's the most reasonable explanation I can think of for how he did that or how Euler did that. Unless we work out a complete artificial intelligence and it can do what Cantor or Ramanujan did. For now, I think the best explanation is the one that Ramanujan gave,
which was a supernatural sort of intervention.
Right.
That's very interesting.
Right.
Now, you mentioned that you read Gödel as a young man, the article about his incompleteness theorem in Scientific American. I also know that you had a near brush with Gödel. And I've heard the story from you, but I've never seen it published. I wonder if you could share that near meeting with Gödel. That was fascinating, I thought.
I think it's somewhere, maybe in a paper based on a lecture. Well, the story was I had been in Argentina for a number of years, and IBM sent me to the U.S. What happened was I was invited to be a summer visitor at the IBM Watson Research Center. And I was living in the YMCA in White Plains. And I'm not sure. This was a long time ago. So anyway, what happened was I had the proofs of one of my first papers on incompleteness. It was from the IEEE Transactions on Information Theory.
Yes.
This was in the early 1970s. And I sent him the proofs. Well, I called him up. And I looked up Gödel's phone number in the telephone book. I called him up. I think he picked up the phone, and I said, Professor Gödel, I have a different approach to proving incompleteness.
So you cold called him then?
Yeah, right.
Wow.
Out of the blue. Instead of basing it on the paradox of the liar, Epimenides' paradox, my approach is based on the Berry paradox. And Gödel answered, well, it doesn't matter which paradox you use. He had said that in his 1931 paper. I was familiar with his paper. So I said, of course, but this suggests to me, I don't remember what I said, something like a whole new approach. I don't know, what did I say? Or a definition of complexity that I would very much like to talk to you about and get your reaction. So he said, okay, send me a paper of yours on this topic. I'll take a look at it. And if I like it, maybe I'll give you an appointment to visit. So I sent him the proofs. I had the proofs of that IEEE paper. It was my second IEEE information theory transactions paper, actually. Did it come out in 74? Okay, so I sent him the proofs. Hadn't been published yet. And I called him up. And he said, very interesting. He said, your notion of complexity is an absolute notion. Now, this was a distinction he made between the idea of what you can compute is absolute. It doesn't depend on the axioms, whereas what you can prove does. So he had taken a look at it and immediately perceived a crucial aspect of the definition of complexity that I was proposing. And he gave me an appointment. This is when I was visiting the Watson Center. So I did some research to figure out, I was without a car, I would take the train into New York City. From New York City, I would take the train out to, I don't know, Princeton Junction or something. And I would get there. Nothing could stop me, right?
Yes.
I was all set for the great day. And it snowed. And this was the week before Easter. So that's unusual, a spring snowstorm. But nothing was going to stop me from, it wasn't a big snowstorm, nothing was going to stop me from visiting my hero. So there I am in my office at the IBM Watson Center, about to leave. I figured out how much time I needed, about to leave. And unfortunately, very unfortunately, the phone rang. It was Gettle's secretary saying, Gettle is very careful with his health. And because it snowed, he's not coming in to his office today. And therefore, your appointment is canceled. So that was a surreal experience. And there was no way to reschedule because I was going to leave just in a few days, heading back to Argentina, to Buenos Aires. But, you know, actually, this surreal story actually fits better Gettle and his legend. Because, for example, when Gettle died, they found lots of answers typed up to letters he received, but were never sent. They were never mailed. So there was a surreal quality to Gettle and to communicating with Gettle.
He was a quirky guy and a germaphobe, if I recall correctly.
Yeah, he was from what at the time was the Austro-Hungarian Empire, and he didn't accept being made a member of the Austrian Academy of Sciences. He never went back to Europe, never visited Europe. He turned down, they offered him to be a member of the Austrian Academy of Sciences. So he's an interesting guy. One of the books I like about Gödel is in French. It's called The Demon de Gödel, Logique et Folie. So that means Gödel's Demons, Logic and Madness. And this was by a gentleman in France who actually went through the Gödel archive at Princeton. Half the book was also devoted to Emil Post, a forgotten genius.
Oh, yes. Emil Post, yes.
Yeah.
One of the things that I'm familiar with that Gödel did that wasn't published until after his death was its ontological proof of the existence of God based on Anselm's argument. So I guess there were a lot of things of that sort.
Yeah, he was definitely a theist. He was living in the Middle Ages, sort of. There's a wonderful story that Rebecca Goldstein published. The Princeton Institute for Advanced Study would occasionally have fancy dinners, basically for people who might contribute additional funding to the Institute or provide political support. And at these dinners, they would ask their stars to be present, you know, to impress the potential donors and other members of the Institute. So Gödel was at such a dinner, you had to go, right? It wasn't optional. He probably wouldn't have wanted to be there. He was at a dinner sitting next to a young astrophysicist. And the astrophysicist was very proud of some discovery he had made, an observational discovery. And he spent a lot of time explaining it to Gödel. And finally, he stopped expecting Gödel to express admiration for the story he told. Instead of which, Gödel replied, I don't believe in empirical science. I only believe in a priori truths. You know, that's an answer from the Middle Ages. A priori truths are necessary truths that don't depend on. So maybe he didn't believe in evolution either. I'm not sure.
Well, he didn't. There's a famous quote that he said, evolution is, I forget the analogy, but it was basically that a printing factory explode and result in a book or something like that. So he was not a big believer in evolution either.
Yeah. So he was a very interesting person, an interesting mind, very powerful.
Very interesting. Well, Professor Chaitin, thank you very much for spending this time with us and getting a little background. I think subsequently we're going to get more into the weeds about your specific work. So we've been talking to Professor Gregory Chaitin, a co-founder of the field of algorithmic information theory. And so until next time, be of good cheer.
This has been Mind Matters News with your host, Robert J. Marks. Explore more at mindmatters.ai. That's mindmatters.ai. Mind Matters News is directed and edited by Austin Egbert. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the speakers. Mind Matters News is produced and copyrighted by the Walter Bradley Center for Natural and Artificial Intelligence at Discovery Institute.